Our first case for argument is Parrish v. City of Elkhart. Ms. Horn.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. This case is about the proper accrual date for an intentional infliction of emotional distress claim. It's not about false arrest or false imprisonment. We concede that those claims and any claims that are derivative of a Fourth Amendment violation would be time barred. This is a case about an intentional infliction of emotional distress arising out of due process violations. As a result, Mr. Parrish could not have brought that claim until his conviction was reversed on December 6, 2005. So his filing 2 years later was timely. The district court and the appellees went wrong by mischaracterizing plaintiff's intentional infliction of emotional distress claim. I think we're talking here about apples and oranges. The district court and the appellees argued that Mr. Parrish's claim was rooted in Fourth Amendment violations, that his harm occurred when the false arrest and the false imprisonment occurred. With all due respect, that's not a fair characterization of the allegations in the complaint. The allegations in the complaint allege that Mr. Parrish was injured by the due process violations that took place, the trial torts. The fact that the defendants in this action used an unduly suggestive lineup, the fact that they fabricated a crime scene, the fact that they coerced witnesses and withheld that fact of that coercion from defense counsel. Therefore,
let me just stop you there for a minute. He certainly knew at the time of the post-conviction hearing all of these things. And so why aren't his claims untimely since he didn't bring them within 2 years of the post-conviction hearing? Why do we have to wait until the exoneration?
I think the discovery rule in this case, which is something that the appellees and defendants have brought up, is sort of a red herring. In this case, because the allegations that he's made are really trial torts that would impugn the validity of his conviction if proved, he couldn't have brought it before his conviction was overturned. If he tried to bring his conviction, if he tried to bring this emotional distress action prior to December 6, 2005, he would have been barred from doing so. I think that Heck, although it deals with the intersection of the federal habeas statute in Section 1983, answers this question for us. The principle being that a civil litigant shouldn't be able to use a civil suit to impugn the validity of a criminal conviction. And that's if you look at the allegations of his intentional infliction of emotional distress claim, that's what they're about. They're about trial torts that took place that, if proven, would have unnecessarily undermined the validity of his conviction. So I think that in this case, it doesn't matter when he discovered the misconduct. It's a matter of when his claim actually accrued. And his claim could not have accrued until his conviction was overturned. Indiana has not addressed this specific issue. The district court and the appellees relied on a case, Johnson versus Blackwell. But Johnson versus Blackwell is distinguishable because in that case, the plaintiff was suing for Fourth Amendment violations. In that case, Mr. Johnson alleged that he was the victim of an unlawful detention and illegal search. And the court in Johnson versus Blackwell said because his intentional infliction of emotional distress claim related back to those Fourth Amendment violations, it was governed by Wallace and the bright line rule that has been developed that those Fourth Amendment violations accrue at the time of the harm or at the time that an individual is held pursuant to legal process. Mr. Parrish's claim, again, is something completely different. He's alleging violations of his due process rights. He's saying that the outrageous conduct that I am challenging is actually trial torts that took place that would, if proven, undermine the...
Did you change your position? In your briefs, you refer to your claims. And in your argument now, you're saying your only claim is intentional infliction of emotional distress?
Your Honor, at this point, we are conceding the false arrest and false imprisonment claims.
Okay.
But the intentional infliction of emotional distress claim, because It deals with a different type of conduct because it deals with conduct that would impugn the validity of his criminal conviction. We believe that it isn't governed by Wallace. It isn't governed by the bright line rule that was developed and that has the Indiana courts have applied from Wallace. It is governed instead by the principles espoused in Heck, which is that a litigant shouldn't use, again, a civil suit to undermine the validity of his criminal conviction. And that's what would have happened here. And I think that even if the Indiana courts have not specifically addressed this question because Johnson only deals with Fourth Amendment conduct, although they have applied Heck in a different case in Scruggs to suggest that that the principles in Heck and the principles of the general tort principle would apply in Indiana law. And I think that makes sense for another reason, which is estoppel. If Mr. Parrish tried to bring his emotional distress claim at the time of his conviction or within 2 years of his conviction or even within 2 years of August 2004 when his evidentiary hearing was held, he would have hit a brick wall as soon as he filed his complaint because the defendants would have been able to say, no, you are stopped from challenging anything touching on the validity of your conviction because you had a full and fair opportunity to litigate that in the criminal courts. So for Mr. Parrish, to give an example, he would not be able to prove outrageous conduct. One of the allegations is that he was harmed by the...
Is this strictly a question of Indiana law?
It is a question...
What does it do with Heck or any of that stuff?
Well,
it's all 1983, so this is just Indiana law?
Well, Heck itself relied on general tort principles in reaching its ruling. It relied on the general principle.
No, but we're just talking about Indiana law here, aren't we?
Correct. It's a state law claim. Mm-hmm. But Indiana courts, first of all, Indiana courts have not addressed this specific question insofar as the only case that exists is a case dealing with intentional infliction of emotional distress based on a Fourth Amendment violation. The other issue is that in the Scruggs case, the Indiana courts did indicate that they would be willing to apply Heck and its principles to claims brought before it. So I think that although it is a question of Indiana law, the general tort principles are the same, and Indiana has indicated a willingness to apply those tort principles in civil actions.
So I recognize we don't have a situation like ours in terms of the intentional infliction of emotional distress situation as the plaintiff appellant finds himself here. But what about generally in terms of that kind of tort in Indiana and when the claim accrues?
Indiana typically for torts would apply the discovery rule. But I think that the discovery rule in this action is not appropriate because of the fact that the claim has not even accrued until his criminal conviction has been overturned. There's a dearth of case law dealing with this specific situation where the intentional infliction of emotional distress claim relates to a criminal conviction. So the general principles, I think, that have been applied in other intentional infliction of emotional distress.
And why are you distinguishing intentional infliction of emotional distress from the other claims?
Because of the basis of the misconduct alleged. So the intentional infliction of emotional distress, the outrageous conduct that he is challenging, are trial torts. So they are due process violations which would necessarily impugn the validity of his criminal conviction.
And by dropping these other claims, like you said, you're conceding you have a problem in terms of when the right to sue accrued.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why you've really dropped those other state court claims.
We appreciate that those claims are governed by the bright line rule that was announced in Wallace and that the Indiana courts followed in Johnson, which is that Fourth Amendment claims accrue at the time of the violation. However, that rule, because it's rooted in the Fourth Amendment, is something very different from what we're challenging with regard to the intentional infliction of emotional distress.
What would you do with this case? The plaintiff, or who is the criminal defendant, he's complaining that there were violations of constitutional rights at his trial, and they caused him emotional distress. But suppose then it turns out that, well, actually, the court rules there were these violations, but they were harmless errors, and so the guilty verdict is upheld. So wouldn't that be a case where the tort was not inconsistent with the conviction?
Well, I think that that might be a case where if the plaintiff... I think that that's a different case from the case here, because certainly if Mr. Parrish had proven up the misconduct that he alleged, his conviction would be overturned. His conviction was rooted in eyewitness testimony. That was it. And what he's alleging and what he has alleged in his civil suit is that those eyewitnesses were coerced into identifying Mr. Parrish, and the fact of that coercion was withheld from him, as well as the use of an unduly suggestive lineup. Those due process violations have been set for trial in October. But in this case, the misconduct could not have been harmless. In this case, the misconduct, if proven, necessarily would have undermined the validity of his conviction. And I think it would be distinguishable from that case. And I know the principle is that in each case, that type of analysis needs to be undertaken to determine whether it would necessarily impugn the validity of the conviction or whether it could be brought regardless.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Horn.
Thank you.
Mr. Tubergen?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. The judge immediately picked up on the problem I have had throughout this appellate process, in that my opponent is creating a moving target, and I never know which exactly claims I'm defending against.
Now you know.
I know. And so I will be brief, I believe. Heck does not apply in this case.
Well, but Ms. Horn just gave her explanation of she summarized her position very succinctly. So what is your comment on that?
My comment on her position?
Yeah,
that's where I'm going. The claim they are making that is at issue here is a claim for intentional infliction of emotional distress. That's an Indiana common law claim.
We're aware of that.
And it doesn't depend upon...
To the point. Come on.
It doesn't depend upon proof of any deprivation of constitutional rights.
Yes, we know that.
Yeah. It doesn't depend
upon... Get to the point, would you please?
Yeah. See, we want to get to her argument about when the right accrued. She's saying it's a trial right. So that's what we want you to answer. She's dropped her other state court claim. She's just dealing with this intentional infliction of emotional distress.
And that is not the claim for intentional infliction of emotional distress is not a claim for deprivation of constitutional rights.
And it doesn't. This is an Illinois. This is an Indiana. This is a state law case. Isn't it? It is.
A state law claim. Exactly.
Look, she made a very simple point. She said, look, His intentional infliction of emotional distress claim depended critically on whether he was guilty. Because if he was guilty, then it would show his intentional infliction claim was no good. And if that's true, then the claim wouldn't accrue until he was exonerated. Mm-hmm. Right, that's very simple. So is there anything wrong with that logic?
Well, he hasn't been exonerated. His conviction was set aside because of ineffective assistance of counsel. And then the prosecutor simply chose not to pursue it again.
And therefore, when will it accrue? It never accrues?
I think it accrued when the injury occurred. And the injury began to occur when he was first arrested and the police investigation started. At that point, he was injured. And then the question is, when did he know he was injured? Well, he knew he was injured right away, as the district court has found.
We assume that, because of Scruggs, we assume that Indiana accepts the Heck principle, which is that if you make a civil rights claim, or, you know, state law tort claim, doesn't matter what, if you make a claim which implicitly challenges a criminal proceeding, you can't, that claim doesn't accrue until that criminal proceeding is over. So her argument is, well, the intentional infliction claim depended critically on the outcome of the criminal proceeding, because if it turned out that these eyewitnesses and so on were legitimate, that kills his claim. So you had to wait until that criminal proceeding was resolved in one way or another. It's a very simple argument, maybe right or wrong. But you must think there's something wrong with that argument. But you haven't explained what you think is wrong with that argument.
I read Heck a little narrower. I think Heck applies. First, Heck applies to 1983 claims.
The Scruggs case indicates that Indiana accepts the Heck principle for its own state law claim. It doesn't have to. It could do anything it wanted. But it seems to accept the Heck principle, right?
But Scruggs was a direct challenge on a constitutional basis to the conviction. And the claim for intentional infliction of emotional distress is not a constitutional challenge to the
Heck. It doesn't matter whether you have a direct challenge to the conviction. All it matters is that if the court were to accept your civil rights claim or here your state law tort claim, that would be inconsistent with your being convicted. That's all that's required. So if the intentional infliction claim is inconsistent with his being criminally liable, then that's all you need to be able to postpone the accrual of the claim.
Well, I think that the Johnson versus Blackwell case expressly rejects Scruggs, and in doing that, it rejects the Heck principle. There's another case that's cited. It's Silvers versus Bordeaux in the appellant's initial brief that dealt with a claim of malpractice against a criminal law defense attorney. And the issue there was whether or not the claim accrues before the conviction has been set aside. And the Indiana Court of Appeals there said there is no requirement of exoneration.
Are you talking about Johnson versus Blackwell?
Yes.
You're saying it rejected Scruggs?
Yes.
It doesn't say that. Where do you get that idea? Discusses Scruggs, says Scruggs is a different case.
Well,
doesn't say it's...
That Scruggs didn't apply. And in that case, one of the claims was a claim for intentional infliction of emotional distress based on a deprivation of constitutional rights. Now, the appellant has indicated that they believe that Johnson v. Blackwell, at least on that issue, is a judicial non sequitur, and I have to agree that the reasoning seems unclear. But the reasoning in Scruggs is non-existent. It's almost a...
I don't understand your characterization of Johnson. What? I don't get it. I know what you're saying. It doesn't criticize Scruggs.
It doesn't criticize it, but it indicates that it doesn't apply in the Johnson versus Blackwell case. And the Johnson versus Blackwell case includes three of the very same claims that are being made here.
That's a case about a false arrest. Johnson's about a false arrest.
That's what we had here until they conceded.
No, but you don't have it anymore.
But Johnson versus Blackwell also had a claim.
It doesn't talk about that. It's just, what it says is that Johnson was immediately aware of the facts surrounding these events and so on, right? So there was no basis, there was no concealment, there was no uncertainty. And we know from Heck and the Wallace and so on, other cases, that if you can have wrongful arrest and so on. You can have all sorts of tort violations that don't impugn the criminal proceeding. But in this case, it seems, for the reasons Ms. Horn explained, that he couldn't prevail, Parrish couldn't prevail without knocking out the criminal proceeding. Mm-hmm. Isn't that true?
That's what they're saying, but I don't believe that's true.
Well, how do you answer his assertion that he didn't have sufficient knowledge at the time of his arrest or conviction to meet the 180-day notice of claim deadline?
I think that's a red herring.
What about the argument that they make that he didn't know till years later the police were the reason behind the false arrest, and so he couldn't have sued the city in good faith without that information? How could he sue the city and he didn't have that information?
Well, the Indiana Tort Claims Act, of course, is statutory, and the requirement for the claims notice is extremely waivable. It is subject to finding of substantial compliance, and if you don't have all the facts, you're not held to the requirement to provide all the facts.
So you can just let it go for years and years.
You can't
let
it go. It
can be waived for years and years.
You can't.
While you're waiting to find out the outcome of the criminal conviction. Is that what you're saying?
No.
Okay. So then that's a problem. So then on the good faith basis for filing a civil lawsuit, what good faith basis would he have since he didn't have any of this information? Wouldn't the case have just been dismissed?
Indiana specifically does not. It provides in its statute of limitation under the discovery rule that you're not required to have all of the facts necessary to file a proper claim. You have to have facts sufficient to indicate that you have been injured by the tortious acts of another, and then you have 2 years in which to develop that claim.
So then the basis of his lawsuit, though, would be very speculative. It would be basically his word against the police officers. He didn't have any information about how they had acted, other than sort of guessing, trying to divine why it was that he was the one that got eyeballed.
It would be speculative when he acquired the knowledge that would put a reasonable person on notice that a tort had been committed against them by somebody. But they've got 2 years from that point to develop the facts and file their claim.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Tuberg. And Ms. Horn, your time ran out, but you can have another minute.
Very briefly, just to address the notice of claim point, one of the requirements in the notice of claim is to demonstrate the extent of injury. And so I think that the notice of claim provision is more usable. It makes more sense when you use it in conjunction with the heck bar. That way that once his conviction has been overturned, he does know the extent of his injury, and he can properly bring his claim and give notice to the city. The second issue is simply that I believe that the appellees continue to mischaracterize the injury that Mr. Parrish has alleged in his complaint, which is to say that Mr. Parrish is alleging due process violations, not Fourth Amendment misconduct. Therefore, Johnson versus Blackwell is not applicable.
And then just so the timing is right, it was December of 2005 when the Indiana Court of Appeals concluded he had received ineffective assistance of counsel, and then it was a year later that he was exonerated and there were no charges brought.
Correct, Your Honor.
I mean, that fully exonerated. In other words, the prosecutor decided not to retry him.
Correct, and okay. He brought his complaint on September 24th, 2007.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Horn and Mr. Tubergen.